This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. As Chattanooga, including this campus, the Tennessee Valley, the nation, and the world confront the coronavirus, we thought we would replay a recent conversation with a maritime risk management firm that has a footprint in the city. Frank Fenner is co-founder of International Maritime Security Associates, based in Florida, but its data center and software operations are here in Chattanooga, where they have been tracking how the coronavirus is affecting shipping traffic for clients around the world. Frank spoke with us last week. Frank, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Ray, it's a pleasure for me to be here with you.
How does a company such as yours track maritime traffic at a time like this?
There's a couple of dilemmas that come into play with maritime traffic. There is systems out there that track ships at sea, but none that bring the information to the bridge of a vessel that we do. So we've developed a platform that's called ARMS, and ARMS brings critical information to a ship at sea, and we look at a couple of different categories. And one right now that's really within the news spectrum is disease and health. And that being with the coronavirus that's out there, we've seen an uptick in how that's affected the whole maritime traffic, port closures, those types of things, or just even delays that could cost overruns that end up into the supply chain, but also people that are interacting with it and getting this virus. There's a ship that's over in Japan right now that's in quarantine, around 3,000 people on the ship, but about 750 had contracted the coronavirus.
And of course, a lot of that shipping traffic either comes from or goes through China.
Yeah, definitely. Since China is the largest supplier of goods around the world, how they've set themselves up over the last 100 plus years goes back a little bit further than that. But with what we're doing now with such a global market, world reach, sometimes these types of things would have never had the impact that it does today. But now there's an uptick in Italy, in France, and other countries that are really seeing an increase in this virus.
Now, IMSA is based in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, but it has a footprint here in Chattanooga.
Well, so that's the unique part about what we do as a company. We looked at regulatory compliance and safety and security for both ships and ports. That's how we started the company. And then we've seen this need for actionable information for a ship. And we knew doing that in South Florida, it could be done, but the cost of doing it would have been a little bit higher than it would be doing it elsewhere possibly. And the other side is that we needed to have a great big pipeline to get information flow. We didn't necessarily have to be close to water. And so when we started evaluating different cities, we looked at five different factors. And one in two of those was having great fiber and great power. Then outside of major weather, outside of like a 9/11 type incident again, and then just the quality of life, cost of living. And when you put all five of those factors in the bag, you pull out a name, you get Chattanooga, Tennessee. So in 2015, we came up here, we did a little research of the city, and in 2016, we pulled the trigger. We set up a corporation here as a secondary operating company from our parent company in Florida. And now in doing so, we've been a part of the CoLab and what they've done with their gig tech accelerator. We also do work right here with UTC, with the Sim Center, and Dr. Tony Shellam over there have been a huge support. We've actually won a grant that's come through UTC via Oak Ridge Labs with some of the things that we're doing in data collection and how we store that data. They're really a great support in advancing the technology, both Dr. Shellam, Dr. Condit, and others that are part of that team when we're there at the Sim Center.
You recently launched a platform that provides real-time data to ships beyond what they've had before. Explain how that works.
Let me go back a little bit and say, hey, this is how ships used to get their information, or actually still do get their information. But we've seen the discrepancy of how things were done. And both myself, I was in the Navy, and my business partner, Corey, was in the Coast Guard. And Corey actually spent a lot more time on ships than I did. And one of the problems that he always seen when he was out there working in the Coast Guard is this lack of information that would get to them. the only ways of communication was maybe a satellite phone, maybe an email, or maybe the next port that you pull into that you get some sort of direct that is given to you. So right now there's a system that on every vessel that's over 200 metric tons, and that system's called the GMDSS. What happens though is every ship gets this information that happens everywhere around the world. And if you're in the Atlantic, you're not really worried about what's happening in the Pacific. And it literally comes in a textual type format, and then you have to go over to your chart and plot it on your chart and see where it's at. Well, what our system does and what we've done here in Chattanooga, we've set up what we call our I2C, Intel and Information Center. And we have people that are there 24/7 operating, looking at different rests from port and canal delays, civil unrest in and around a port, and obviously health epidemics that could be happening around the world. And then there's some other ones that we look at. And we say our real-time window is every 10 minutes because the fact that ships aren't traveling at an exponential speed that's somewhere between 8 and 12 knots that they're navigating the world. So every 10 minutes, our platform that rests on the bridge of the ship interacts. And what we like to say is it's a Waze traffic app for ships at sea at a greater granular level, or on steroids, as sometimes we say.
And how does this situation compare to other situations that this platform has monitored?
We're constantly monitoring things. So we've even seen things with migrancy. And one of the things we don't do, we don't command or control any ship. What we're trying to do is provide the best information available to the decision makers so they can decide, hey, do we need to go to a different port? Do we need to look at how we interact with shoreside personnel? And those are the things. They set their protocols. We give some guidance in that if they request it, but we never try to sit there and say, this is what you need to do or what you don't need to do. But we want to give them critical information to make the best decision possible.
What's something that people might not know about shipping and the work that companies such as yours do?
One of the biggest things that people don't realize, 90% of what we use daily has a lifetime on the ocean at some point. And that's the biggest thing that people don't realize, that of the really the world is connected by ships. Even though things get flown by air freight and everything like that, the cost of doing that is 10-20x versus floating something across on the water. And the other thing is there's been a new expansion of the Panama Canal within the last 5 years, and now we're able to get Panamax ships in. Now the problem for that on our side now is we went from container ships that were 7,000 to 12,000, and now some of these can go up to upwards of 20,000. The infrastructure that exists at the ports doesn't have the resources to move these containers in and out at an efficient level yet. We're getting there, but we're a little bit behind on that side. And we believe that what our platform does will help in that whole just-in-time shipping. And the other side that we didn't realize being here in Chattanooga was the logistical community. We were naive or just uneducated in regards to what Chattanooga had as far as the logistical community, and then other companies like FreightWaves moving forward and providing that into their side of the shipping world and tractor trailer as well.
All right, Frank, thanks so much.
Hey, it was a pleasure to be here, Ray. We really appreciate it.
That was our conversation from last week with Frank Fenner of International Maritime Security Associates. You're listening to Scenic Routes. More in a moment. This is Scenic Routes. I'm Ray Bassett. Last month, we spoke with Sam Hall, an amateur historian who started collecting and publishing vintage photos of Chattanooga back in 2014. Photos on loan from Sam's site, ChattanoogaHistory.com, are part of a series by Mark Kennedy at the Chattanooga Times Free Press, titled Remember When, Chattanooga? Sam also knows quite a bit about WUTC, and that's where we began when he stopped by Scenic Routes a while back. Sam, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And I should say, welcome back to WUTC.
Seems that way.
You have quite a connection with this station and in particular this studio.
That's true. My dad built the studio, Parks Hall, probably in the mid-80s. He was an engineer here. He's happily retired from radio. He worked in radio in Chattanooga for many years for many stations, did a lot of studio work, taking care of transmitters, all kinds of technical things.
You are into radio, and you are also into history.
Big time. Yeah, I sure am.
And tell us more about where your passion for history has taken you.
Well, I'll go back to when I was in college, I was interested in genealogy and family history. And that took me so far, but I found that I really enjoyed the history part of it more than the family history, because you run out of things, you know, to research. I've always been fascinated by old photos. I wanted to find out more. I wanted to research. So fast forward to about 6 years ago, I found some very neat history at the Library of Congress. They had digitized tens of thousands of photographic negatives, glass plates, and a lot of them were from Chattanooga. So that's how I started looking more into how do I interact with these giant images that are out there. And that's what led to the idea to create a website about it. Website is called ChattanoogaHistory.com. A lot of people know it as DeepZoomChattanooga.com. That was the first domain I used. And it essentially lets you take and explore interactively high-resolution photos of the past. I don't think most people realize how much detail can be found in photos from over 100 years ago. We are used to seeing them in newspapers and in books, which is very low resolution. So when I found these at the Library of Congress, I couldn't do much with them because they were so big. It choked the computer. But I found software that allowed you to interact. It's called Deep Zoom. That's what Microsoft called it years ago. And I kind of branched out from that and kept looking for copies that were large and available in public domain, and then started to find pictures and negatives that were available that I could scan in high resolution, and people can enjoy them and see all kinds of details. We've been able to uncover details that weren't previously known about an image because it was in low resolution, and now it's in high resolution.
Give me an example.
Okay. So also, I don't restrict it just to images. Maps, you have to get detailed. You have to really get down on them, and you can read street addresses. You can read all types of data that normally you'd have to get a magnifying glass to look at. That's available to folks. We've been able to uncover. When I say we, there's a lot of other people like me in town that kind of collaborate, that are history enthusiasts, okay? So there are some glass plate negatives that became available about 5 years ago. Didn't know anything about them other than they were obviously from Chattanooga. We were able to determine who the photographer was, where he lived, and from that, lots of details, because he would walk around really this area, lived at Battery Place, and would take pictures of people in their front yard, would take pictures of down 3rd Street. So a lot of times it's just putting the pieces together, the puzzle pieces, and identifying, well, if this is this address, then this person lived here during this time. So a lot of that genealogy knowledge comes in handy when you're doing the research on images.
And how far back do these photographs and maps go?
Probably most of them, 1880s is as far back as we go. Really, Chattanooga doesn't have any photos from pre-Civil War that we know of, because photographers came in with the Union Army. It was a commercial opportunity, right? And so that's when we start to see a lot of photos. So Chattanooga has an abundance of Civil War images. Just all of a sudden, after November of 1863, here come the photographers. And a lot of them stayed. A lot of the Union troops stayed, too. They said, you know, this is really a lot better than where I'm from. I'm going to stay here and build the city. So that's as far back as it goes. It's actually harder to find photos from, I would say, the 1960s forward. They're still in somebody's basement, or they've been thrown away. So we're seeing a lot from, I would say, pre-1930. Around 1900, there was a huge proliferation of people doing photography. I didn't realize that until I started looking in pictures, and everybody's got photos everywhere. Apparently, it was a hobby that just was huge back then and affordable.
The new media of its time.
Yes, people took to it very quickly. Luckily, some of those still remain. So that's one of my goals, is to still find glass plates, negatives, even original prints, and digitize them before they're gone. Like film negatives would disintegrate by now if it was that old.
And what you have found yourself and with the help of others, what gaps does what you find fill in about Chattanooga that most people, even lifelong residents here, might not be aware of?
Well, little stories that are forgotten after a generation or two. For instance, in March, we'll celebrate, I don't know exactly what, I could do the math, but I'm not good at math on the fly. But, you know, in the 1920s, Broad Street did not continue through to from approximately MLK Jr. Boulevard. There was a set of buildings there. There were railroad tracks on the other side. And it was Georgia's property on the other side. And it had to do with the railroads. Well, this is a neat story that came back to light. Chattanooga and Tennessee could not get Georgia to hand over that property. They really wanted to extend Broad Street south of that line. Finally, the mayor and others got together and said, I tell you what, we found a legal loophole. I don't know all the details, but essentially late one Friday when the Georgia legislature was closed, they got a bunch of bulldozers. They'd already got all the people out of the buildings and the businesses. They bulldozed the buildings, and apparently that allowed them to break through, and they had a band playing, marching to Georgia or something like that. And you know, so there was this huge coup that took place to allow extension of Broad Street. Little stories like that. Chattanooga had a bicycle coliseum at one time. That is, I can barely find any information on that. All kinds of little stories that come forward and were huge in their time. But they will be forgotten if somebody doesn't uncover them. Same thing with stories of today. We think these things that are important to us today will last forever. Nah, not really.
The photos and maps that you do have offer another view. They enhance the view of a very different city, a city centered on manufacturing, a city in the aftermath of the Civil War and during Jim Crow segregation and all the rest of it. It fills in those little details, as you were saying.
It does. You get to see. I'm from Chattanooga, lived here all my life. I remember in the 60s when it was just not a place you would want to go downtown after 6 because it was just, there was nothing to do. A lot of pollution. It didn't smell good, really. We've had a huge transformation. But back then, we can see in the photos what it was like. It was downtown was huge, like most cities. It was the center of the shopping universe. That is fascinating to see how busy it really was. And up until a certain point, the city stopped at Missionary Ridge. That was the countryside after that. Before the early 1920s, Brainerd Road was not heard of. It was Bird's Mill Road because there was a mill called Bird's Mill until a group got together and wanted to pay homage to David Brainerd and the Brainerd Mission, and that's how we have Brainerd. Those are cool little facts that come out. History continues to give entertainment and cool facts.
You actually have a vantage point having grown up on Signal Mountain and now living in Hickson.
That's right. I did grow up on Signal Mountain, and so I have appreciation for the geography and live in Hickson now. I'm glad I didn't have to move away because it's a great city. I'm glad I'm here. I'm not going anywhere. I just wish that back when I was younger, I had more of an appreciation for history, and I wish I'd taken more pictures. And that's one of the things, the mantras I try to tell everybody is take some interesting pictures that are boring today that will be more interesting tomorrow. I took my 35mm film camera in 1982 to high school. Yes, I'm old. And just took pictures in the hallway, in the cafeteria. Everybody probably thought I was weird, but now I'm a genius. It's like people are going crazy.
Right. Turn the camera away from you and take the pictures.
Yes. Selfies are boring. They really are. It says, you know, and I tell people, I say, you know, I don't want pictures, just portraits of people, but if they're in front of a landmark or walking down the street, those are really interesting because you look at everything around them and how it used to be, and you get a snapshot into what life was like back then.
Tell us more about Remember When.
Yes, the Times Free Press approached me with an idea. They had noticed, and rightfully so, that history generates interest on their paper. They can track what people spend time on, their digital paper. And so they said, would you like to help us present some photos? I said, sure. And so there are remaining, you know, tens of thousands of negatives from the Free Press that a fraction of them have been digitized. And I say a fraction like 30,000, but there's many, many more. So I'm hoping those get digitized. But anyway, we pull from that, and that's how we started. And they looked at some photos and said, this one, let's use these. And we've started rolling it out every week, about 3 weeks ago, I think, interesting photos. And then Mark Kennedy over there does a great article. He does the research and the backstory. The first one was of a group of teenagers in, I believe, 1953. And all of the teenagers in that photo are still alive. They're about 83, 84 years old now. And that's a cool story. That's the kind of thing I love to see come out of this interest. And because somebody thought, had totally forgotten about that photo. And it was just a typical photo of them at a Coca-Cola stand, all with Coca-Colas in their hands, because it was a advertisement for Coca-Cola in their upcoming yearbook.
And it starts with the photo, finding the story to match instead of the other way around.
Yes. Yeah, right. It's take the photo and then work backwards. There was nothing in that photo that really gave us any clues as to where, other than we knew when because of the way it was labeled, and it took somebody noticing it. Social media has helped immensely in getting the word out. I think newspaper, it always surprises me, a lot of people that have not seen the website and they're reached through traditional media. I suspect after someone hears this interview, they may say, what was that website? ChattanoogaHistory.com. A lot of times you'll be searching and a lot of things from my website pop up in that search. So I say, go have fun with it. It's totally free. It's a hobby.
And what you do and what you do with the Times Free Press, you rely on others bringing forth what they have, and you rely on partner organizations in this community, including here on this campus.
That's right. Well, the UTC Library houses what was the Chattanooga History Center. So a lot of the content that was with the Chattanooga History Center, which I first worked with and they were still around, came from that collection. I would like to see a lot of that come out eventually. I think there's so much that could be done with it, but I'm really happy that it landed in a safe place. There was a lot of concern that it might not, so we're fortunate. I've worked with the library. Libraries aren't museums, though, and so one of the things myself and others really hope is that someday we'll have a history center. Chattanooga is one of the largest cities in the U.S. not to have a history museum, and I mean just a straight-up history museum, not like a niche thing. I'm hoping to see that, too. Now, I've got a full-time job, so I'm not going to be able to build that anytime soon, but when I retire, maybe so.
And in the meantime, where can people go online to follow Remember When? And again, your website.
ChattanoogaHistory.com and then the Chattanooga Times Free Press website. I believe they usually release things on Tuesday or Wednesday. That varies a little. So for those of you that subscribe, you're going to see that pop up. In those articles, you can read more. And then when you click the link to my site, which I feature this on the front page, you can go to the Remember When page and explore those images in full resolution.
All right, Sam, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Scenic Roots on WUTC. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. Our show is produced by Haley Solomon, Carly Dodson, and Will Davis from the studios of WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Follow us on Twitter at scenicroots423 and email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Also, follow WUTC on Facebook and Instagram, and listen online anytime at wutc.org and the WUTC app. Join us again next time for Scenic Roots.